Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the endarkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Hello, this is Steve Behrman, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light forward to where the evolution is taking us. Today on Wiki Politiki, we're going to be talking about two themes. First, the theme that has been emerging ever since we had to choose between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in last year's election, that our democracy has become a mockery, a mockery of rule by the people. The most telling moment was on 60 Minutes, just before the election last year, when they had 25 people, voters from across the political spectrum, and they asked them the question, how many of you will be voting for the candidate of your choice? And three of them raised their hand. The next question, how many of you will be voting against the other candidate? And the other 22 hands went up.
Eesh.
I think it was Jim Hightower who once said, if God had meant us to vote, he would have given us candidates. Now, as you come to understand the current situation, situation better, we recognize that the candidates are really chosen in the primaries by even fewer people. And as we saw with the Democratic primaries in 2016, the insurgent candidate who could have likely beat Donald Trump was thwarted by the party mechanism at every turn. Our guest today, Sander Hicks, is a Renaissance person. He's a musician, a writer, an entrepreneur, an activist, a carpenter. That's pretty intense. Who is running for Congress in New York's 12th Congressional District against a Democratic candidate who was elected by just 15,000 votes last time in a district with 700,000 voters. 2%. Oh, when she voted for the Iraq War and the Patriot Act. So that's the first thing we're going to be talking about. In addition to the innovative platform that Sander has created that calls for public interest venture capital, among other things, Sander Hicks has also been a 9/11 truth activist. This is the second thing we'll be talking about, and how that plays in a country that well, we call it Nazism, where people choose to not see what's in front of them. So I think we're in for a lively discussion today. Welcome, Sander.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Swami.
Okay, good. Well, let's begin with the campaign. First, what prompted you to run? And second, what makes you think you can win?
Okay, great. Well, what prompted me to run was the uncaring, the insouciance of Representative Carolyn Maloney. I was a part of a group called Citizens for the release of the 28 pages. We petitioned our congresswoman to at least respond to us and tell us if she was going to support or not support the release of the 28 pages. On behalf of the victims' families of 9/11, we felt that these were secret documents that had been censored for far too long. Then, lo and behold, Senator Bob Graham later advocated for this cause and went on 60 Minutes and then really kind of loosened things up. He eventually helped get them released through that major media appearance and the pressure of that. But before that happened, Carolyn Maloney was just extremely unhelpful. She sent us no response back for about a year, and then finally sent a form letter about the wrong issue. So you couldn't think of a worse kind of response. And her politics really are insensitive to the needs of the people. It's a very safe district. Mm-hmm. We could be having a real progressive coming from this district. That whoever wins the Democratic primary is 98% certain to win the general election in this district. So what we're saying is, since it's such a safe district, then we really need an advocate for progressive causes, for the people, for peace. You know, somebody that can push the Democratic Party forward on progressive issues, not backward into neoconocratism. That's what she really is. She's not a Democrat. She's a neoconocrat.
We actually, we call that the combination of the neocons and the neolibs, we call them dem public rats.
Dem public rats, yeah. Yeah, she's been in public for far too long. She's never really had a real job. She's been in government bureaucracy all of her life. And it shows. It shows he doesn't. She's not really connected to the people.
Lack of imagination.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, she's never had any kind of entrepreneurial experience, any bootstrapping and the real world, having to like start and employ people, start a business and raise capital and pay the bills of a small business, which is an insane struggle. And I'm here to make it easier for people to do that.
Yeah, and it's really rare. It's really rare that people from that kind of domain end up in the machine part of this of politics, where it's expected that you kind of move up in the ranks by not making any waves, and then eventually you get to run for public office. If you're lucky, it's a safe district. Now, you were saying earlier that there are some certain challenges in New York in the Democratic Party to actually get people even to vote in the primaries. What's that all about?
Right, right. So I'm touring the country right now. I'm seeing a lot of states have open primaries. In New York City, it's the absolute opposite. Yeah. Very closed primaries, meaning you have to be a Democrat and you have to register something like a year and a half before the Democratic primary to be a Democrat to vote in that primary. So I learned this when I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary. I got in right before the deadline to be able to vote in that primary. And it was well before our actual New York primary. And I am also running this campaign to help the American people give a voice to all the skepticism we have about our election system, about electronic voting and the need for a paper trail, about the fact that the closed primaries are a problem, the lack of a national popular vote, the Electoral College is a colonial institution that needs to be replaced with a national popular vote. So that if the majority votes for a presidential candidate, then guess what? That candidate wins the election. Simple, right? And the people that I'm talking to, my groups, I poll them. I ask them what they think. They think, yeah, that makes sense. So and in New York City especially, the system is extremely corrupt. It's a patronage system, Steve. If you are friends of the good old guys, good old boys, you can get appointed to be a clerk of the Board of Elections. It's a very nice job. It's $120,000 a year. You don't get elected. There's no public scrutiny to your appointment. It's patronage, right? So if you – and this is what happened. We had 200,000 voters get thrown off of the primary election rolls. A lot of them had Latino names. A lot of them showed a proclivity to maybe not vote for the anointed Democratic Party candidate that year, and they might have voted. They showed a high risk of voting for Bernie Sanders, and therefore had to be eliminated. So this was a huge scandal in the Board of Elections, and actually our Attorney General in New York State did suspend Betty Ann Canizzo, who was the Democratic appointed clerk of the Board of Elections. And she had been appointed by her friend Frank Sedio, who's the Brooklyn Democratic Party chief, and he's a known Hillary supporter. So, something's rotten in Denmark, in New York City.
Well, you know, I grew up in New York City. I spent my deformative years there.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Tammany Hall.
Right,
and
Tammany Hall.
That was like the archetypal political machine, you know, where it was a guarantee that, and that's why there was actually a four-party system. There was a conservative party, mm-hmm. and there was a liberal party.
Right.
And often a candidate would run as a fusion candidate with the liberal and democratic imprimatur. So there was at least a way for that voice to be heard. And, you're talking electoral reform. Our mutual friend Mark Crispin Miller, who wrote the book about – he was on my show a while back – who wrote the book on – the rigged elections in 2000 and 2004.
Yeah.
And one of the shocking things that he found is that the progressive press wouldn't touch the book.
Yeah.
And he talked to John Kerry. John Kerry gave him a look after the election. I'll do something about it. Of course, nothing ever happened.
Well, you can't expect people that are already elected to really, really care about this issue. You got to. We have to have a nonviolent revolution in this country. We have to elect a bunch of new people, and those people have to make a commitment to real elections, real democracy. That's what it's all about. And this whole Citizens United thing is really about giving all these extra privileges to big money, as if big money needs more extra privileges. But the Citizens United versus FEC decision gave such a voice to big money to drown out the voice of change makers and progressives. So that's what's really dangerous about the Citizens United decision. And more people are waking up, Steve. I think 65% of people across the political spectrum are saying that dark money and secret donors and anonymous donors are a part of the problem. Special interests need to stop influencing our elections.
You know, and that's really important. And, of course, in this little district, or not that little, it's 700,000 people there, in this district, what is the strategy for, you know, overcoming those odds of how challenging it is for somebody who is new, mm-hmm. who wants to vote in the primary, who may be an independent, who may lean Democrat? Inside the district, is there a particular strategy for activating those people who actually vote in the primaries?
Sure. Well, we have a potential 250,000 registered Democrats in our district. Only 15,000 of them voted in the last primary. We're going to go face-to-face. We're going to canvass. We're going to go into neighborhoods that have some of the smaller buildings that we can knock on doors in. We're going to go to neglected parts of the electorate, like Queens and Astoria, Sunnyside, Woodside, Massbeth, Queens, which are in our district. But Maloney tends to stay isolated in the Princeton Club, and she parties with the Koch brothers out in East Hampton. So she's not really interested in these working class neighborhoods.
She does party with the Koch brothers.
She parties. She was actually criticized in the New York Post pretty roundly for partying with Trump cabinet officials and the Koch brothers at the publisher of the Washington Post's Hampton's estate. And Maloney is really kind of this is like the outsiders. This is like the Sosias versus the Greasers,
yeah,
Steve.
Yeah,
you know,
because
and I sing or have sung in a rock and roll band, a punk rock band, and Maloney, on the other hand, she sends her kids to private school. She owns a lot of real estate in North Carolina. Her husband was a Goldman Sachs vice president. She's amassed all of this personal capital. I don't know how she did it. I'd love to know. How do you make $26 million on a congresswoman's salary? She made $28 million in 26 years on a congresswoman's salary.
So she's been in the office for that long.
Yeah, 26 years of doing very little for the people.
Yeah.
You know, we just released a man on the street kind of video talking to people in New York City face-to-face on camera with a almost making like our own little TV show. It's on hicksforcongress.com. And just asking people, like, you know, a lot of people know that Maloney is their congresswoman, but then I say, what does she stand for? And you're like, or what does she really believe in? What has she really done for you? I just kind of vote for her because she's running, you know? And it's kind of like, we have so much more to offer.
That's really, really good. Talk a little bit more about your background.
Sure.
You mentioned the band, some other entrepreneurial ventures.
Sure, sure. So I was the independent publisher who took a stand with honesty and integrity up against the Governor Bush campaign for president back in 1999 to 2001. This was my big struggle. I was really passionate about it. I was a very independent-minded young activist publisher. I reacquired a book by a working-class author named Jim Hatfield, and we republished his book, Fortunate Son, George W. Bush and the Making of an American President. So I got very close to him and worked very closely with him. We were up and down the corporate media roller coaster. We were on 60 Minutes, Washington Post-style section, front cover. We were also sued by his old friends in Dallas, Texas. And so there was a lot of highs and a lot of lows. And it was a great opportunity to see the power of corporate media. And I kept on thinking, like, gosh, you know, if we've got the truth about Bush, if we've got the story, they'll go for the story. And I think a lot of his assumptions were, you know, he had an ambition and a nose for scandal. He really wanted to be
your author?
My author.
Yeah.
He really wanted to make his mark and be a great investigative nonfiction author. And so he pulled out all the stops, and he brought out everything about the SEC investigation that young Bush had been through and the bin Laden-Bush business relationship with Salim bin Laden. And we were doing this stuff in 1999. This is years before Michael Moore made it semi-less controversial by putting it in his movie Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
So, so I kind of had a very rough lesson in corporate media, and I realized that the corporate media tends to go along with what the corporate media has already said, or they tend to go along with status quo opinions or stereotypes rather than look at something unbiased. And so our author's problem was that he had he might have actually been set up by Karl Rove, because he knew Rove and he knew people in Texas, and we think that he might have been given this Bush cocaine arrest story so that his Bush cocaine arrest scandal story, when it came out, people could turn around and blame Hatfield and talk about Hatfield's past, because he also had some skeletons in his closet, you see? So part of what was in his book was that Bush had been arrested for cocaine possession in Texas in the early 70s.
I remember that.
Remember that? It was a story, it was a story long rumored to be true, quote unquote, by the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And he felt that he had gotten a higher level of proof and evidence, three sources.
So he was fed something perhaps by Karl Rove.
That's the way Rove tends to work, yeah. So that's what we think.
Misinformation.
Right, right. Unfortunately, Hatfield died in July of 2001, right before 9/11. He was the only controversial biographer of Bush, and then 9/11 happened right afterwards. So when I was taking a leave of absence from the company, I actually moved out of New York City on the 10th of September 2001 to take this leave of absence in Long Island, living with my aunt out on Long Island, Huntington Station. Mm-hmm. And I was given the opportunity by the angels or the universe to study what was really going on in our world, in global politics, Saudi money, Bush family intrigue, JFK, and, of course, the Afghan-Soviet civil conflict, and, of course, how this all led to CIA working with radical Islam all throughout the 80s. And, of course, I ended up doing a book about 9/11 and talking to whistleblowers like Randy Glass, who had worked with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and FBI, and whistleblowers like Delmar Vreeland and other whistleblowers, Robert Wright from FBI, who gave a tear-filled press conference saying that FBI, his division of the financial wing of the FBI, had tried to stop bin Laden. They tried to track bin Laden, and they were stymied. You know, well, now it turns out we know now bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, was actually an asset of the CIA. He had a CIA code name named Tim Osmond. He worked for CIA and the MEK and Pakistani ISI, working with the Afghan Mujahideen all throughout the 80s, you know, and we don't get to know about this in this country. We don't get to know that the CIA's Larry Mitchell visited Osama bin Laden in Dubai at the or in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, in the American hospital there. This was reported by the AFP, the Agence France-Presse, right before right around the time of 9/11, but it wasn't picked up by the corporate American media, which again tends to at the very least, the kindest thing you can say is that they just tend to report what the consensus opinion is. Other people say that they are controlled by elements of the deep state or influenced by elements of the U.S. State Department. And I think there's an element of truth to that. You know, Carl Bernstein wrote a article about that in 1977 for Rolling Stone.
We are going to be taking a break. It's been a really exciting little segment here. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the deep state, the press, and so on, and how we can bring this to light.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course? Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to CorporatePrey.com. Corporate Prey. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket. A tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with segment two here with Sandra Hicks. We're talking about his campaign for Congress in New York, and we're also talking about his going into deep research on the deep state. Continue with that. You did some research. What did you uncover in that period of time?
I uncovered that the United States government does, in fact, lie, and it's okay to say that. The government has a history of lying, especially around war. And I need to say that I want to live in balance. You know, I'm not looking at this darkness because I'm obsessed with the darkness. I'm actually a creature of light and a creature of peace. And I think that the country is actually capable of a huge, huge possibility. And I'm here to declare that there is a new opening for us to realize that we've had a past of lying about war and lying about the incidents that get us into war, like Gulf of Tonkin or the battleship Maine or the 1991 Cube-80 incubator, you know, lie. But it's not where we have to be, that we as a country are an international consortium of peoples and that we can live together and we can be in peace. And that I think our future as a country is an enlightened country, an enlightened place that will begin to preach and teach and live by example the code of nonviolence, conflict resolution. So I don't want to just make this talk just about the minutiae of the war on terror and what I've discovered. I'm here to also say that what I've come out of, you know, I'm going to give you a taste of where we're going to end up here, I guess. Mm-hmm. What I've come out to say that, like, at the other end of this stuff is not more negativity or the abysmal information. It's actually to think like, oh, okay, so the United States government told a series of lies about 9/11. And the U.S. State Department even attacked its critics. In 2006, the State Department said the 9/11 truth people are wrong. There's nothing to see here, people. You know, that which is, to me, problematic. You know, if the U.S. government itself
already
has
suspicious.
Yeah, suspicious behavior, right. Yeah. The 9/11 Commission was a total whitewash. You know, anybody that reads that report and reads nothing else will say, oh, it's inherently, internally contradictory, right? So we need to be a country of truth and honesty and integrity, and that means doing a little bit more work to do conflict resolution rather than war at the drop of a hat. And we're capable of that. We're a very intelligent country. We're a country that I think is aching for some kind of spiritual renewal. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about the guts to recognize unity, to recognize yeah, what is the American spirit? I think the Bill of Rights is really beautiful. I'm proud of our Bill of Rights. I'm proud of the First Amendment. You know, the five freedoms of the First Amendment having to do with freedom of religion and also freedom of speech and how these things, you know, go together and the right to dissent. So that's the openness and the spirit that I'm running on, this positivity, you know, this trying to point to what's good about the future and point out what we're not seeing. You aptly described it as Nazism. It's not seeing it, you know, and people are refusing to – a lot of people in the corporate media and the corporate government are refusing to see the problem. But the American people, on the other hand, do see the problem. The American people, according to poll data, do want a new investigation of 9/11. And so just maybe we'll deal with 9/11 briefly and then move on. But I'm really hopeful because my friends at the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry are about to file a grand jury petition in federal court in New York City in the next week or so. Mm. And this is going to be a major historical undertaking in which we're going to have a grand jury petition to the U.S. attorney. So the U.S. attorneys are not being asked to adjudicate this. They're being asked to review the petition and convene a grand jury petition based on the scientific, assertive, and dispositive evidence. That's what the lawyer's calling it.
Dispositive. Is this positive or is that positive?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly. It's New Yorkese for dispositive. This is pretty positive. Yeah. That's what they're calling it. Dispositive and not merely persuasive, meaning it disposes of your doubt. And there's 20 categories of evidence having to do with explosions at Ground Zero. And so this makes people sometimes a little bit antsy. But listen, people, just look at the videos of the buildings. Those buildings are falling at free fall speed. Building 7, the CIA headquarters itself, is falling at free fall speed. Anybody that can just kind of calm your mind, take a deep breath, and look again at the video, and just recognize it in the history of architecture, no steel frame structure has ever collapsed due to fire, period. You know, and so it's kind of like you need to kind of calm down, remove yourself from the anxiety-laden corporate media, and you know, and realize that YouTube is a gift from a higher truth.
Well, you know, it's interesting that what you just said. I'll go back to the Transpartisan Citizens Summit that I went to in 2009 in Denver, 200 or 300 people from across the political spectrum, and there was somebody there who had instant keypad voting. And one of the questions was about 9/11. In that room of people across the political spectrum from all across the country, 70% believed that 9/11 was either intentionally an inside job or it was allowed to happen.
Yeah.
70% of the people in that room.
Yeah.
And yet, in mainstream media, we can't talk about this. So I think the election of Donald Trump is directly related to people on the right waking up to this deep state idea, perhaps knowing a little too much about a lot too little, and the people on the left simply not willing to look at it whatsoever, and the shock that people had that Hillary lost the election, that Trump won, part of that, and I know people, we probably have mutual friends who, you know, saw that Hillary was the deep state. Hillary represented deep state, more dangerous than Donald Trump, and so on. And because of the denial on the part of progressives, until now, we have things that are even worse than what we would have had had Hillary been elected. So, bringing this to light, truth and reconciliation, and helping people face the heart of darkness, which is really, really important these days.
Right, right. Yeah, and some people, even in the 9/11 truth movement, said that they were hopeful that Donald Trump would convene a new investigation. He seemed to indicate that, you know, when it was time to dispose of Jeb Bush, he was very happy to bring up the Bush collusion with these rich Saudis that were related to bin Laden. He was very happy to nail Jeb Bush for being part of the family that let all these rich Saudis fly out when nobody else could fly out. You know, I don't care if you were an American that needed a heart transplant. You couldn't fly after 9/11. But the rich Saudis that were related to bin Laden, they could fly. So that was huge for Trump And I even wrote a little blog post saying, like, you know, Trump is terrible on immigrants. He's terrible on sexism and racism. But this is interesting that he's willing to use, you know, 9/11 skepticism or the Saudi-Bush connection when it suits him. But he's not a man of integrity that's willing to do what's right or act out of truth. And you mentioned truth and reconciliation. That's what we need in this country. You know, the South Africans experienced that under when they were trying to heal from apartheid, you know, and truth and reconciliation hearings and the process is one of truth telling without retribution, you know, and this is something you have to kind of let go of revenge and let go of anger and hatred. And it really is a spiritual calling if you can embrace the possibility of truth and reconciliation. And I do like to talk about spirituality and politics and truth and the you know, because I feel like we're all, it's universal. We're all truth seekers in this country, right? And this country does identify, I think 71% of the country identifies as Christian. So I would try to connect to that, whatever your opinion is of Christianity. And, you know, we all know it's a mixed bag, but I think there's something really great about the core values of this radical traveling preacher, carpenter from Nazareth, who just said, you know, I think we should try harder to love each other and get away from what society is telling us to do. Which
and throw those money changers out of the temple.
There you go. Okay, good. Now you're getting radical. But and I've been reading Rabbi Jesus by Bruce Coburn recently.
That's Bruce Coburn. Yeah, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, great book, great guy. No, that's exactly. Who are we thinking? So truth and reconciliation, I think, is something that we should do in this country about a number of different issues. You know, we could do it about the legacy of racism. We could do it about the legacy, you know, the American apartheid system, you know, the why we have all these Confederate memorials and how are we going to heal the country when we have these things that are reverential memorials to a racist secession movement, you know. I brought this up in Texas. It didn't go over very well. But in California, I'm doing better. So.
Well, I think it really, you know, again, it's complex because, you know, our founders, many of them had slaves, and the entire country benefited from the slave economy. I mean, that, you know, not just the South, but the North did.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of our history and legacy. And the idea behind truth and reconciliation is to do it without blame, but to do it with clarity and forgiveness and healing. And this has been, and I know you would agree with this because you just said it, that the missing piece in this country has been the sacred at the center, which is why money has taken over.
Yeah, right.
And so what you're calling for, like so many people, and we can talk about this a lot, is a new sense of the sacred that includes and transcends both religion and non-religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people are getting excited about that because they see that if we were to gather together as people, the virtues and values we have in common are vast. But because we've been divided into these two tribes, we haven't been able to unify to hold our governance accountable.
Right. Whenever you bring people together, they want to share their stories. So if you bring 100 or 1,000 or even 10,000 people together in an assembly and you begin, you know, letting people share their stories on a microphone, it really becomes an amazing experience of unity and empathy. And then I think this is the kind of thing that people can retreat from stereotype, retreat from dogma, retreat from partisanship, and get out of the mentality of making other people wrong and making yourself right, and get more into illuminating our common ground, right? Everybody wants honesty in government. Everybody wants everybody has basic human needs for food, clothing, and shelter, and a sense of compassion for those that maybe have, you know, disadvantages. And I think that there's a way to unify people. And I think the you could call it the spiritual process, or just call it the process of coming to terms, of a deeper understanding. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been experiencing in different assemblies that I've been a part of.
Have you been able to express this as part of your campaign, that element of one might call it spiritual, but it's even more mundane than spiritual. We tend to put spiritual up here. It really is how human beings relate to one another through the golden rule, through how we treat others.
Well, I will say this, that our campaign is based on our website has a lot of video that's spontaneously made with the people. So just going out into the street, going out and just hanging out with activists and people who really care in front of the People's State of the Union, or going out into Union Square in the district, Congressional District 12, and just spontaneously meeting people with a microphone and asking them what they care about, what do you think of the incumbent, amazing new discoveries are being made. We're learning about organic food in Uganda, and what food is like in Uganda versus the expensive organic food in New York City, and what are the differences. Yeah. And, I feel that there's a light within us all, and there is spontaneous creativity. If you give people a platform for it, then it comes out. And social media, by the way, you asked me how we're going to win this race. We are going to go face-to-face with a lot of people in our district. We're going to canvass a lot. But also, the incumbent has zero social media. She doesn't get it. And we're all about social media. I've got 5,000 friends on Facebook, and there's a wiki about me, and we're doing lots of online video, and our social media guy thinks he can win this race for us through social media alone.
Well, that's very interesting, and I think that's probably true because, again, many of these insurgent campaigns, and you could look at Bernie Sanders' campaign for mayor. You could look at Paul Soglin's campaign for mayor in Madison, Wisconsin, back in the early 70s, activating the students there. They both won by surprise. And when they won, they were both supposedly socialists. When they won, the first thing that they did was they enrolled the business community in working for the benefit of all, and they benefited as well. Bernie Sanders revitalized the downtown in Burlington, Vermont. Mm-hmm. And this is the same kind of thing that you're talking about. Want to hear more about your ideas related to using the entrepreneurial energy to do some outside-the-box things.
Great, great. Well, when you say the word entrepreneur, a lot of people think, they think like a capitalist exploiter or, some jerk, some white jerk that went to Yale or something like that, So I use it slightly differently. I think of somebody who has figured out how to take their creativity and their new fresh ideas and apply them in the real world setting. So this is the opposite of philosophical or academic. It's actually very practical, and it really does improve things. So if the inner cities need entrepreneurs, and there are entrepreneurs in the inner cities because we all have spontaneous creative energies. We all have artistic creativity. It depends on if the system is going to listen to it or not, or give you a platform for it or not. And our system tends to give all the advantages to the white jerks from Yale and not to inner city entrepreneurs or possible entrepreneurs. So since the Constitution gives the U.S. Congress the right and the privilege and the ability to print and mint money, and we've gotten so far away from any kind of sense of democratic capitalism or democracy working with capitalism as, we tend to think of capitalism as being kind of counterposed to the will of the people in this country, and that doesn't have to be that way. I would try, since we're in a post-socialist world, that we've got to kind of try on new ideas about worker cooperatives and the Mondragon experiment. I know you had that great show about Mondragon, and I really enjoyed it. So my idea to kind of build on ideas like Mondragon is to say that the United States government needs to go out on a limb and take some in the name of the public interest, in the name of the social good. We need to find the entrepreneurs who are already out there that have business ideas, or maybe they've already started out and they have a business going for a year or two and it's already at a break-even phase or profitable. People that have a track record or really good ideas to that will benefit society, and we need to give them capital. We need to develop a relationship. Maybe there's an equity stake there, and we need to infuse them with capital and know-how. And let's talk about this more at the other end of the break.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to take a break very soon. Yeah, it's how this thing works. We'll be back with Sandra Hicks very shortly.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, you know your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
We're back with Sandra Hicks. He's running for Congress in New York. He's really also creating an educational campaign. In a sense, he's part of the great upwising.
Thank you.
So let's continue now with some of the ideas that you have for actually creating new, in a way, new institutions and new ways of cooperation above and beyond government, civilian, all of these distinctions.
Yeah. So what I saw in the 2008 credit crunch meltdown and bailouts was a government completely subservient to Wall Street and big banking. And it doesn't have to be that way. We could have a government serving the economics of Main Street, not Wall Street. So I'm not anti-capitalist as much as I am anti-crony capitalist. And as an award-winning entrepreneur, I could talk about that for days on end, but I'm proud of my background as an award-winning social impact entrepreneur.
Say something about some of the things.
Sure. So I've been an independent publisher, founder of Soft Skull Press, and we took on the Bush family and did a whole bunch of social activist and alternative rock poetry books and history. We did a left-wing history of World War II that changed my life, you know, just learning about these things by being a publisher and editor. Then I went on to start a coffee house called Vox Pop during the war on terror times of jingoism and alienation. I said, let's open up a coffee house that's all about connection and community empowerment, media education, and also there was some publishing. We published a newspaper and books, and we had our own print-on-demand book publishing machine, and all the coffee was fair trade, and the workers were union at one point, IWW, and
The Wobblies.
The Wobblies, exactly. Wobblies. Yeah, that was good. At the time, there was a big union drive against or with the workers of Starbucks. So the Starbucks workers were trying to organize against a anti-union management at Starbucks, which eventually beat them into pulp. But we were kind of like a city on the hill. We were like the pro-union coffee house that welcomed the union in at that time. So, and that's the context for that. And then I went on from that to start the company I'm running today, which is called Zen Space Makers, and it's a carpentry craft collaborative company. And we have a website called loftbedsnyc.com. And this company is, I think, moving closer and closer to take the first steps towards becoming a worker cooperative like Mondragon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is very, very socially entrepreneurial. You know, in looking at where we are now and where you're going with your campaign, et cetera, and I know we could probably talk about the UNRIG conference a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
What do you find is the most encouraging for you right now? What's encouraging?
What's encouraging is that the people have woken up and they've refused to vote for establishment candidates. So I don't believe in President Trump's politics, but the very fact that people took a risk and they voted for somebody that they thought would offer a different set of goods than Hillary Clinton is, I think, somewhat interesting. Although I'm a progressive and Hillary Clinton is more of a progressive than Trump is, so it's hard to, you know, nothing I'm saying right now is like totally black and white. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I wish the Democrats had had the guts to vote to use a common sense decision. We're living in a time in which anti-establishment candidates are winning big, right? And so the man or the candidate to put up would have been Bernie Sanders and not Hillary Clinton. One of my more well-known articles is called Hillary's Secrets. It's been up for 10 years on Rents.com. And, so I've been trying to tell the truth about Hillary Clinton and her background with the deep state and Iran-Contra and Rose Law Firm and MENA, Arkansas, and the Iran-Contra narcotics connection there. And there's some really weird stuff.
And you think this is pretty established information.
It is. Well-sourced information. Yeah. The book by Evans Ambrose Pritchard is a great source on this stuff. But a lot of the corporate media tends to vote Democrat and tends to be kind of timid about certain issues. So if you talk about things that are outside the scope, you know, like your generation had, you know, 15 years of the Warren Commission report being stoutly defended by the CIA. The CIA published these documents saying we have to make the term conspiracy theorist, a black tar brush. And anybody that dares question the Warren Commission report is a conspiracy theorist. And then in the late 70s, we had the House Select Committee on Assassinations conclude, according to acoustical evidence, there were more than one shooter at the JFK killing. So that is the U.S. government contradicting itself. You know, you had Alan Dulles, the CIA director who Kennedy had fired, strong-arming and controlling the Warren Commission report. And then you had the CIA telling the media for 15 years, we have to make the term conspiracy theorist extremely pejorative so that people are scared of questioning the Warren Commission report. And then the same U.S. government, you know, in a different branch, legislative branch, you know, the will of the people, Congress, releases a half-hearted, somewhat timid, but essentially truthful report that there were more than one shooter at JFK. So that's my hope. My hope is that the will of the people will come out and that truth will be able to come out and that we as a country can rally around leaders who take a stand for integrity and science and verification and not stereotype or hysteria.
Hysteriotype. That's a new word.
Hysteriotype. That's what we're up against. Yeah, the hysteriotype that we can't question legends. We're talking about myths.
Yeah.
And myths and legends are very, very strong. That's why the Philip Zelikow, the head of the 9/11 Commission, was actually an expert in myth-making. That's what he wrote his dissertation on.
Yeah.
And so we're dealing with emotions here. We're dealing with myths and legends. But these same myths and legends are toxic, and they led to the Iraq War, which Carolyn Maloney, the incumbent I'm running against, voted for. And so she's partly responsible for the genocide of a million people, all based on myths and legends that Saddam Hussein is out of control and that he's not, you know, playing ball with the weapons inspectors and that, you know, he might have a nuclear weapon, the mushroom cloud might happen. Yeah, that's what Condoleezza Rice said. And yeah, these myths and legends, if we have a society that doesn't take a stand and go up against the official story, then really a series of dirty wars ensue. And then we as a country are responsible for the Syrian refugee crisis and for the creation of ISIS and the creation of chaos in Libya and Iraq and Syria and Yemen.
And we broke it,
Powell
said.
We broke it. Yeah, then we ought to fix it. We're living in a global society right now. We can't be isolationist. We can't just walk away at this point.
And now, you know, it's like the mainstream press is like Little Boy That Cried Wolfowitz, if you know what I mean.
Right.
In that, the New York Times has no credibility with the people who've done any delving into the deep state. I mean, you know, you're not, you're in a certain regard, you took the opportunity to peek under the covers and look behind the curtains, and what you saw was so many of the things that the right wing have been saying about Hillary, the alt-right. My God, that's really true. Now, of course, there could have been exaggerations thrown in. There could have been more things thrown on the fire. From the alt-right.
And here's what the alt-right isn't saying, but people on the left are saying, is that she also voted for the Iraq War. She also urged President Obama, to unseat Gaddafi by supporting rebels that would, kill Gaddafi. And I think they had he died a very gruesome death, and it involved sodomy with a bayonet, I believe. And it was by Hillary's urging that the U.S. supported the rebels and sent Libya into civil war and strife and chaos and death. And that's what I think the critics of Hillary should really be saying, is that she's a hawk and that she didn't deserve the presidency because she wasn't really representing the standard of progressive democratic America. And so she couldn't even decide whether she was a progressive or not. And so therefore, I feel that she was not a real Democrat. And she was a neoconocrat, just like Representative Carolyn Maloney, who is – and they're very good friends, by the way.
Yeah, this is really interesting because of this mistrust of the press right now, it's almost as if, there's a center that can't hold.
Yeah.
And perhaps the new center that will hold is around – the kind of quote-unquote spiritual issues that you were talking about, that, mm-hmm. It really is it's ethically very, very challenging to vote for the lesser of two evils, because then you have to defend your evil. So had it turned out the other way, we would probably, we'd be in the position of having to defend Hillary, just like the Republicans who voted for Trump because for them he was the lesser evil. But then you're always defending evil. That's really the insidious part of it. In this two-party duopoly, you're always defending evil.
Which is why we're running a positive campaign. We don't have any of the negative stuff about Carolyn Maloney on our homepage. Our homepage is all about the videos, us talking to the people, laying out our positions on consciousness, interfaith awareness, peace in our day, public interest venture capital, the possibilities, the declarations. We're running weekly conference calls with peace activists and truth seekers and freedom lovers across the political spectrum, across the country. This race is so much more than a local congressional race. We're making it a national referendum on, can we the people send an activist from the peace movement to Congress? Somebody that can be like Alan Grayson out of Florida, somebody that can be like Cynthia McKinney, former congresswoman out of Georgia, Paul Wellstone, the late great Senator Paul Wellstone, who voted against the Iraq War and paid the price. So
He paid the price. And there are people who there's the inference, what happened, how did he get Wellstoned, so to speak?
Right.
And the people on the progressive left have not really been willing to look into the heart of darkness.
Yeah. And I think you need to be in touch with your own light if you're going to look into the darkness. Nietzsche said, be careful when you look into the abyss, because the abyss might look into you. And I think you have to kind of know where you stand. And so I credit my spiritual background. I was an atheist for 10 years, but I had 12 years of Catholic education, and now I'm kind of a – I practice Zen meditation, and I go to Quaker meeting, and I am committed to faiths that believe in peace and believe in the light that is universal. That there is, we got to stop kind of worshiping things outside of ourselves and kind of realize that God or the higher power, the higher consciousness, has made us to be vessels of light, and that we are made to love each other. We're mammals. We're made to nurse each other, and we have compassion. We can actually feel each other's pain. That's what's amazing about ourselves, that like we've got these brains that have evolved after 13 billion years of evolution. We can actually we're kind of superheroes. We have superpowers that can feel each other's pain. And that means that we're going to want to help each other and not have a politics of cruelty or a politics of giving up, but a politics of empathy and compassion. And you know what? And so to people on the left who think like all of this is BS, stuff, I actually think like, no, what you don't get is that there's a power in this stuff. And there's a power in all of the wisdom of the world's religions, and that they are not the domain of the right wing, and they are the domain of the people of peacemaking and compassion, and Jesus and Buddha and all the saints and Dorothy Day and all the Islamic Sufi saints and poets. You know, they're all with us, you know, living, dead, whatever. They're all with us, and that this is an incredible power that can help transform the world. When people get together and they believe in the same thing, they believe in the same vision that's positive, they change the world, and they attract other people to change the world. It's a mass movement for peace.
This is what the uprising is about.
That's right.
You know, some wise person said, spirituality is our connection with the divine, and religion is crowd control. So the people, you know, many of the people who identify as atheists, it's not that they don't believe in some higher power. They just don't believe in religion. And so so it's a reaction against, you know, what perhaps you might have gone through in Catholic school and what a lot of people went through in their patriarchal expression, you know, kind of like trying to fly on one wing, expression of spirituality. And so what you're putting forth here as the in a way invisible core of your campaign, that's the invisible core of the entire campaign. You're not pushing against, you are simply putting forward.
Right, pointing a finger towards the moon.
You know, it's funny, there was that famous quote by Alan Watts, who said, instead of worshiping the finger, notice the direction it's pointing. You know, and so that's probably what what this new spirituality is about. It's simply about living something rather than, following some kind of dogmatic teaching. And
I'll tell you something really practical. I didn't think I was going to be able to like go to my Zen retreat in December. It's a Rohatsu retreat. And then I decided, you know what, I made a commitment to go to this. And even though I'm campaigning and running a company in New York and trying to figure out how to campaign more and run the company less, I think this Zen retreat might be good. So I did I made good on my commitment to do the retreat, and I was so happy I did, because things really changed. So I went into this retreat thinking like, okay, so there's this weird homeless guy that just called me and said that I can help him and that he wants me to help him. And I was pretty brusque on the phone with him. And so in the middle of the retreat, some voice came to me, and it's really in my own head, but a different voice that hadn't really been listened to before kind of came out after, like, you know, 13 days of intense meditation and going to Dharma talks and cleaning the floors bent over. And that's a form of meditation too, because it's very practical stuff, Zen. So this voice said to me, you know what? You can actually help this guy. There's something, this guy's in your life for a reason. And he called you and he said you could help him because you can help him. So I decided to do that. And this guy is now kind of a part of our company of carpenters and laborers. He's got his own issues and manic neurotic intensities, but he's also really good on the phone. And so he's good for drumming up new business for the company. And I did that by listening to this voice that said, things happen for a reason. And if a homeless guy says that, oh, and by the way, he sleeps on the floor of the office in Queens. Don't tell my landlords,
yeah,
Steve,
yeah.
But
they may not be listening to the show.
Yeah, right. Well, they're very spiritual people. They're Orthodox Jews of Queens, New York. So,
I totally understand that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? We're coming, believe it or not, this is hard to imagine, but we're really coming toward the end of our conversation. We've got another, 30 seconds or 40 seconds. Is there anything you want to leave people with related to your campaign and the way forward?
Wow. Wow. Well, it's not just about me. It's about a movement that's out there. You and I both saw that at Unrig the System. It's funny that turns out that 2 weeks ago we were in the same conference in New Orleans. I'm really hopeful about leaders in our country like Tulsi Gabbard, Democrat, progressive Democrat out of Hawaii, who wants to do things like pass H.R. 608, Stop Arming Terrorists Act, you know, have the USA stop working with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria. I'm really hopeful about other movements like Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats, trying to focus all of this angst and urging for change and focus it into some disciplined work and disciplined activism. Running for office has been great. I urge everybody to do it, because if you're an activist, it takes your activism up to the nth level. And, you know, I've done civil disobedience against Yemen now for the first time because I need to be a new kind of candidate.
Okay, we're being interrupted by the music. Sander Hicks for Congress. Go there. And you can see it on my page at WikiPolitiki. Steve Behrman, thank you so much, Sander Hicks.
Thank you, Steve, for letting me on your show. HicksForCongress.com.
Yeah, .com.